Career Disruptors is the podcast for senior managers who are not afraid to challenge the status quo, who challenge assumptions and who push the boundaries and love shattering conventional wisdom. I'm Coach Caroline DeKimper, empowering professionals to build a personal brand that gives them the confidence they need to go after the career they want and deserve. Today on the show, we have Natasha Hawker, and Natasha's going to talk to us about how to build employee assets and not liabilities. Now, Natasha is a director of Employee Matters. She's also a speaker and author. With over 25 years experience, she is an expert in employment relations, recruitment, performance management, terminations, and mediation. Natasha is routinely featured in the Sydney Morning Herald, ABC Radio, and the Huffington Post, and she's a regular writer for Flying Solo and Her Business Network. She has an impressive background, and we are honored to have her on the show. Welcome, Natasha.
It's great to be here, Caroline. Thanks for having me.
No worries. Now, before we dive in, I would love to find out your background story. Why are you so interested in this topic?
Yeah, it's interesting. If I go way back, my career actually started in banking and finance, working in dealing rooms, and everyone used to say, I think you'd be really good at personnel management, which was what it was called way back then. And then I thought there must be something in this. So I started studying part-time, as you do, just to make sure I liked it. And then I started to make my break. And the funny thing was, as often happens with people in their careers, I had 2 years education background, but no one would take me as a HR person. So I became a recruiter in an agency, and I did that for a while. And funnily enough, that's how I learned how not to run a business. But those skills, I have to say, have come back to me a lot, because when I started my business, as you know, Caroline, you have no clients. So I had to cold call. And the skills that I got in the recruitment agency came back to me absolutely to do that. But, you know, I think for me it's around being incredibly passionate about people. I've always loved working with people, and the stuff that other people find hard, I find really easy. Yeah. And so then my career started probably now 25 years ago. The journey's been for me, and I still love it as much as I did way back then.
That is brilliant. So tell me, how did the transition actually go? So you started in recruitment in an agency, and coming from that background, I know it's like cutthroat and really, like, really intense. So how did you go to really deepen in HR and in employee relations?
Yeah, so when I left banking and finance, I got a job, as I said, with a recruitment agency. And what I will say about them was they had excellent training. You know, they did a lot of training in-house about how do you make a cold call, how do you do an interview. So that was really valuable. But it was, you're absolutely right, Caroline, it was incredibly cutthroat. As in, we used to run a book on how long the latest person that joined us would last. And we'd run... And, you know, it could be as short as a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks. But what I realized very quickly was, whilst I found the cold calling really uncomfortable and I didn't like it, and I didn't think I was good at sales, what I did know is when I got a client, I had them for life. I was really good at building relationships, and I was very good at follow-up, and I did what I said I was going to do, and I had good values. And so I actually ended up staying for 3 years. And I made great money. And that's, interestingly, that made it hard to leave, because then I actually went to try and get a job, my next job in HR, like was always my plan. And I had to take a massive pay cut. Yeah. But I did it because I knew that the end game was I wanted to be a HR generalist, not a recruiter. Yeah. And I was getting bored. It was very similar, very samey. And I wanted to broaden my skills. And so I then got a lucky break and joined a global management consulting firm, and then very quickly went back to study again. So this time I went off to university part-time and studied a postgrad in employment relations. So then my career sort of took off from there.
Yeah, perfect. So if you look at it, the transition that you made, did it confirm your interest? Because often I see if you come from recruitment into HR, it's a whole different world. And even though recruitment is a part of it, sometimes it can open your eyes that you have like so many different aspects. Like you have your policies, your onboarding, you have like the employee engagement that you have to look after. So there's so many moving parts. So what was it from all that spectrum that interested you the most at that stage?
Yeah, I mean, I really think I got my lucky break when I got to join that management consulting firm. And actually, funny story, a girlfriend of mine actually saw the ad in the paper. I didn't see the ad. And she's one of those girls that gets feelings. Yeah. And she said, Natasha, you have to go for this role. So multiple, I think it was five interviews later, I had the job and I was on a plane to Brisbane. And the funny thing was, Caroline, and this shows you how that whole fake it till you make it, because that I'd been working in recruitment, we didn't have actually computers. Everything was done manually. This is showing you how old it was. So I then went into this top global management consulting firm and they had technology like you wouldn't believe. Yeah. And I hadn't touched a computer for 3 years and tried to get something to print. I would be there till 7:30 at night trying to work it out. How I survived and stayed in the role, I must have been a quick learner, I don't know. But what I found was, and why it was my lucky break, was I found out what I believe and still use today was HR best practice. Mm-hmm. And now I apply it in a way that makes commercial sense to small to medium businesses. And yeah. What I loved was the variety, and what I loved was the people piece. So it was around, you know, I went in initially in a recruitment role and then I moved into the generalist role. And I loved the talking to people and trying to work through difficult situations and, you know, when they'd miss out on a promotion. And you know, I then transferred to London, and unfortunately I was involved in making 50 people redundant very quickly after September 11th. Yeah. And what I realized was that whilst that's incredibly challenging, I had a gift. I was good at it. Mm. And I was very surprised at how often very senior people in businesses were dreadful at it. They really struggled. And so I was able to help them do it better and help the individual who was going through the process as well. And I really enjoyed, you know, making that process easier for all people that were involved.
Yeah. So when you talk about HR best practice, like what, in your words, what does that look like? Because a lot of people will say like, oh, that's best practice, but it's so difficult to sometimes understand what is the real best practice and yeah. what do you need to look for?
Yeah. Look, I think one of the things, and this is something I've been working on for a long time, you know, people used to say very much that HR, it wasn't really valued. We were known as the policy police or soft and fluffy. There was no real detail and understanding of what we did. So I developed something called an employee asset model, and that has started to help people understand it. But for me, best practice is really around doing stuff well, doing all the little things well, and understanding the bigger picture. So what I mean by that is, for example, most people never learn how to recruit particularly well. They're never taught how to interview. They go in there, they might have copied a previous manager or they've Googled it, and they go, yeah, I know how to do a behavioral interview, but they really don't. Right. And then obviously they often get, you know, they reap what they sow. They get a person that they shouldn't have really hired. The next thing is they skip and they leave out bits. So I've seen this even in the corporate world where orientation and onboarding is not done well. Your employees are at the greatest risk of resignation in that first 6 months that you hire them. But even at the flip side, I can remember one of the organizations I did a contract for didn't do exit interviews. And there were people bleeding from this organization. And I was like, why aren't we capturing what the trends are here and using that information to make better decisions? And so for me, best practice is a lot around data and analytics. So I developed a tool called Employee Metrics, which actually assesses a business for its current levels of HR compliance, risk, and best practice. So we need to understand what we're doing and make sure that we are continually doing continuous improvement. You know, how can we make this process better? How can we make sure that our managers know how to hire, manage, and exit? Most business owners and most managers have never been taught those three simple things.
No.
And they're not simple, but if they just knew how to do that, that's part of being a manager. And unfortunately, they've not been skilled in that area.
I think it's like a combination, or I believe the reason why they don't put high importance maybe on it is because they have such a high pressure already to achieve their targets and to achieve results within their area of expertise. And they don't know the importance of having the right people on board in the first place and then really giving them a solid onboarding. Because if I speak to all of my clients practically and ask them about their onboarding, and we go through in the beginning, we do career mapping, which is an exercise where we go through all the jobs and basically understand, okay, what was your experience in that opportunity like? And like, most of the time they say they didn't really had a decent onboarding. Mm. So many people even said like, oh yeah, my computer wasn't ready and my password wasn't ready. And it's like so common. And you think like, oh my God, this is like a massive transition in an employee's life. Like to join a new company, they feel vulnerable and uncertain. They like the least you can do is to give them a solid onboarding. To make sure they're welcome.
Absolutely. I mean, you think about it. I can remember a similar example where there was a senior manager who came in who at the time was probably being paid somewhere between 150 and 180 who didn't have a computer or a laptop for 6 weeks.
Yeah.
You know, you are just making that person completely non-productive. Yeah. And I think most businesses and managers don't realize the true cost of hiring. And it costs between 50 and 150% of the base salary every time you hire, 50% at the more junior end. So the average salary in Australia is about 65K. And at the senior end, if we're talking CEO and C-suite, it's 150%. It takes them a long time to really make an impact. Yeah. And so that's very expensive. Even at that 65K, you're all in costs, which is time to hire, recruitment costs, you know, how long it takes to train up the employee, the time for the employee to get fully productive in their role, that's about $32,500. That's a lot of money. Yeah. And businesses don't realize that. So then if they have an attrition problem and they're losing people or bleeding people very quickly, then that starts to get very expensive very quickly.
Yeah, that it's all the indirect cost, isn't it? But the cost that they can see is like when they go to a recruitment agency, it's like, oh yeah, it costs so much because like they see the 20-25K that they have to pay up front, but actually they don't understand that their own actions also can lead to a much, much higher cost in total because they didn't do the proper onboarding, or they didn't provide the proper training basically, or they didn't recruit or interview well in the first place. So you were talking about an asset model. So tell me more about that. What do you mean by that and how does that work for an organization?
Yeah, so one of my big goals is actually to let banks lend you money on the value of your employee asset. And if we think about it, Carolyn, banks lend money based on machinery and plants and equipment. Yeah. But often most businesses' biggest expense is their employees. If it's not the biggest, it's the second biggest. Yeah. And we do nothing on that space. Yeah. So you think about Google, the massive attraction and valuation of Google for me is the brains trust that sits inside of that. Yeah. So what we've done is come up with what we call an employee asset model. And essentially it's 9 steps to build employee assets. And a great way to think about it, and I would encourage your listeners to actually do one step forward and actually assess themselves out of 10, with 1 being poor and 10 being exceptional, how well they think they do this in their business or that their business does it. So the 9 steps are hire. How do you hire the best employees that you can afford? Yeah. Manage. How do you manage them to optimize their performance? Mm-hmm. Measure. How do you measure your return on investment? And that's what we believe builds a high-performance business. Yeah. The next level is around training. So the next step is training. How do you train your people to basically make sure that they're great in their job, but also that you're doing stuff like appropriate workplace training and all of that sort of thing. The next level is engagement. My favorite, you know, engagement is the measure of discretionary effort. Do you have a highly motivated team? Yeah. And then the last one is around workplace health and safety. That these 3 components help you build a great culture. Yeah. And then the last 3 steps are assess. Are you compliant with your workplace obligations? policy? Do you have the right policies in place? And lastly, exit. Do you exit both your non-performers so you're not going to get sued, ideally, and also your performers that you might like to get back? And that helps you manage risk in your business.
Yep.
So that's what we see as the 9 steps to building employee assets.
Oh, and what do you see is the most common one that, it, or the 3 most common one that are just completely like not in order?
Not done at all.
Yeah.
Measure is absolutely fundamentally a big issue. So an example being, most people don't know how important it is to have a highly engaged or highly motivated workplace. And essentially what I mean by that is to have a disengaged or not engaged employee, they now know, costs you 34% of their salary.
Wow.
So if George is there and he's either actively working against you or he's just not doing anything, it's 34% of his salary on a yearly basis is what it costs the business for that not to happen.
Wow.
And I actually think big end of town still struggle to really get their head around this. Mm-hmm. The next one I would suggest is still around assessing their risk. So modern award is complex. We've just seen a whole lot of stuff happen. It's almost every day there's an audit being conducted on a business where they're not paying the correct wages and entitlements. Businesses lack compliance in that area. They need to make sure that they're doing the right thing under their award and that they're compliant. I think a lot of people still think, Caroline, that you know, as long as I pay above the award, everything's okay. But that's not the case. You still have to, for example, consult on major workplace change. And that might be we're moving offices or we're going through a redundancy period and there's a certain process you need to follow. And then the other one I would have to say is around that, you know, that engagement piece.
Yeah.
You know, if you have a team that are engaged, 75% and above, Harvard Business did a whole lot of surveys on this and study around this. You get 75 percentile and above, you get 21% more productivity and 20% more profitability.
Yeah.
Now, I would say most businesses would like some of that. But we don't think about that. We don't think about how can we make our team happier? How do we build a flexible workplace? You and I were talking offline. You know, flexibility is the number one attractor of businesses, of employees or candidates to a client. And, you know, big end of town are still struggling. We do a bit of job share and we think we've got it covered. We haven't. We need to make the workplace lot more about output and less about bottoms on seats.
Why do you think that people are so reluctant to change that, like leaders and companies?
Trust. So an example personally in my business, I have on 2 pages our vision traction, which is an EOS thing, Entrepreneurial Operating System by a guy called Gino Wickman. So on 2 pages, I have my 1-year strategy, 3-year, 10-year. I've got my exit price. I've got what our vision is, what our mission is, what we're focused on over the next couple of years. And my whole team have that.
Yeah.
So, and so I'm enormously transparent with my team and that builds trust and it builds engagement. Most businesses would not give that information freely. In fact, we very rarely give any sort of information of detail or confidential nature to our employees. And, you know, you might argue someone might take advantage of that. Probably maybe over time, 1 or 2 people might. But the lift I get for being so transparent and communicating very effectively with my team is our engagement levels, and we measure them every month, sit at 88%.
Yeah.
Month on month.
Yeah.
And a big part of that is around trust and, you know, authenticity and telling it like it is.
Yeah. So, and because a lot of leaders that I would talk to, they have this own perception that they're very transparent and that they often look for only results and they're not getting that. So there is often what I see is a disconnect between how the perception of the leader is, their self-perception, and how the employees see that leader. So how do you break that? How do you get that friction away? How do you close that gap, basically?
I think, you know, a lot of it is preempted by the environment. You know, there's lots of rules and structures in our larger organizations, but still relationships and trust are important. So I think the best thing is to take it back to basics and build trust and relationships. You know, actually care about what your team do on the weekend. Actually share a little bit about what you do. I actually share when I stuff up. you know, I did something the other week which made my team laugh, and I was cutting and pasting something, individual cells in Excel, and the team went to me, you don't need to do that. You could have copied and pasted the whole lot. And I'm like, there is a reason why I'm in HR and not IT. But I share that and I go, well, I've learned something. I won't do that again. And so I make myself vulnerable. I don't believe I know it all. And I often say when I go out to clients, I'll say to them, my team are infinitely better than this and that, what I am. You actually don't want me on your job.
Yeah.
You actually want my team. And when people see their leaders being authentic and acting in that way, it builds trust, it builds credibility, it builds the fact that those people will go further and farther for you, because, and it's reciprocated, you know, that both sides of the relationship are happy to do that.
It is so interesting that you say that, because I'm just reflecting back on leaders that I worked with, and then so we did a 360, and so they become aware that they need to build and increase their engagement and build that trust, like you say. And then so the pitfall that I see that they fall into is that they start a process, but then they go back to old habits quite quickly because they give up and don't see that it works. Have you experienced that also, that you see that people just like revert back to being not maybe a micromanager, but being more like isolated, not transparent, because they say, you see, it didn't work, and have all these preconceptions. Mm.
It's funny you should say that, because I've just started meditation and I've been doing it for about 6 weeks now. And the classic example is when someone says, I meditated once or twice and it didn't work for me. It doesn't work like that. I'm a great believer in what doesn't get measured doesn't get done. Yeah. So I have had 9, and they have varied over the years, KPIs, which I hold myself to account for every single week. And there should be no reason why corporate managers haven't set up their own KPIs that they know are going to help them get success, that are working them towards their goal. So an example being is I need to speak to, for example, 10 of our prospect clients every week. I need to do a podcast every week. And it's either yellow, red, or green. Have I done it or haven't I done it? And then I have to opt up to my exec meeting and say, oops, I didn't do that last week. I'll focus on it. I'll make sure that I get that one done this week. So I would encourage all your managers to build their own KPIs that's going to help them achieve what they want to achieve and achieve for their team, so that they can't miss that coffee that they should have had. And I think sometimes too, we go a little bit, oh, we went and had coffee. And that's great. But what was the objective of that coffee? Yeah. And did that person get out of it what they should? And I will always say to people now when I have a meeting with them, I know we've got 30 minutes and I know you're incredibly busy. When I walk out of here, what do we need to have achieved for you to feel like you got value from this 30 minutes? Yeah. And even just asking that question, the person's blown away. But they then generally give me exactly what I need to do to make to impress them or to give them what they want. And they're going to be much more inclined to work with me or to, you know, develop a relationship with me because I've put that out there in the first place.
Yeah, exactly. Now, we already spoke about some of the consequences that companies or managers would experience in terms of the cost involved by hiring the wrong person and not onboarding them. But what are other consequences? Like I would say like the reputation management, because the reputation of a company, like what are the other consequences?
There's a lot. So there's obviously, if we talk about recruitment, there is the expensive cost to replace and the likelihood if you don't change what you put in, you're not going to change the outcome.
Yeah.
So if we keep doing the same things, it's going to happen again. Often this means you're unable to achieve your overall business plan and strategy, or your team, your department business plan and strategy, if you don't get the stuff right. And you can go out of business at the extreme level. But also, you know, as individuals, I know that we want to do the right thing. And I think that in particularly in my space now, Caroline, there is some big change. You know, there's some big fines for getting it wrong. And I think people have the perception that's okay, the company can get fined. Well, you're right, the company can get fined. For example, if you unfairly dismiss someone, the company can get fined. It could cost them up to 6 months' salary and or reinstatement. For the individual, which is expensive. But if we think about a breach of the Fair Work Act, where you knowingly as the manager knew someone was being underpaid and you did nothing about it, you are now personally liable for that.
To the tune of
up to $12,600. So if your organization is doing the wrong thing and you knew they were doing the wrong thing and you chose to stay quiet about it, you are now personally on the hook. So, you know, that I think, you know, especially in my space, if I have a client that's doing the wrong thing, I actually have to walk away from them now. I can't service them anymore. Yeah. I don't have to report them. It hasn't gone that far, the law, but I can't continue to work with them.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of consequences. And I think the main one is I am a great believer that if you could do three things better, hire better, manage better, and exit better, your business is going to do better.
Yeah.
You're going to be more profitable. You're going to be more productive. And life is easier. You know, I have a friend who said to me, running a business would be so much fun, Natasha, if I didn't have employees. And I know she's not alone. A lot of people feel like that.
Yeah.
A lot of people think that about their people that they manage. You know, they're often not skilled. So the other thing that I would do is encourage learning, you know, do great reading. Make sure that you read extensively on your subject. Make sure that you're continuously improving your own skill set beyond what the company's prepared to send you off to training. And I think that's one of the sad things I've seen is that when the global financial crisis was coming, training budgets got cut severely.
Yeah.
And they're still not back to where they should be. And I think that we are getting the impact of that downstream now, where we don't have highly skilled people. It's a very tight applicant market. It's hard to hire great people. And it comes back to starting way back when we didn't invest in our people and for, you know, they don't necessarily have the skills or attributes that we need for now.
I definitely agree with that, Natasha, but I also think it is like the responsibility sometimes of a leader, him or herself, to actually further educate themselves, because like I'm just like my brain is thinking about like how many people there are that are lacking certain managerial skills, because you said like they hire, manage and exit. So manage is of course a big part of that. It's like, how do I show up as a leader? And I think people think it's like you've been born with a special gene or something that you're being a leader just naturally, but that is so not the case. And people don't understand that it's a skill that you need to develop yourself. And it's, yes, it can be the company responsibility, but if you want to take on more and more people management responsibilities, then it would be in your own benefit if you want to achieve your target, if you want to lead high-performing teams, that you actually step up and educate yourself if you feel that that is lacking in your experience.
Oh, absolutely. One of the books I'd highly recommend is a book by a guy called Derek Gaunt, who wrote How Ego and Authority Impact Your Potential, and it's around leadership and it's around the skills. And I think, you know, it comes back to that basic relationship skills. You know, we need to get better at understanding the people that we're working with and working out how we can get the best out of them and get the best out of us and work together for that.
It is such an interesting topic, like building trust, building relationships, because everybody that I would speak to says like, yeah, I can build relationship. I'm a great internal or external stakeholder manager. Like that is something that I'm really good at, but it's only one side of the coin. I'm curious more often if you talk to other people, if they have the same perception of that person, if like, because it's not because you think you're good at something that is really the case, basically.
Yeah. And I don't think we're very good at asking for feedback on ourselves. I think, yes, we have some formal processes, the 360 that we do.
Yeah.
However, again, I would come back to, you know, if you're working with one of your team members, I would say, you know, a simple one is, what do you want me to do more of? What do we want me to do less of? And what would you like me to stop doing?
Yeah.
And so that you're continually evolving how you work together. And when you ask it that way, it's much easier to ask them for something as well.
Yeah.
You know, what I need from you is this.
Yeah.
And I think that it's around having those difficult conversations. And I still think people avoid them and people aren't comfortable having them. And, you know, I think we sometimes need to be vulnerable in order to get more out of a relationship.
So I have a question. So if you have a leader or a manager that actually at the moment says like, look, I'm aware I've done things the wrong way, but I have now a team. Like, how can he or she start now rectifying their relationships and start building that trust and building that relationship again? What would your advice be, like how to start from scratch?
One would be to start with an apology. The second thing would actually to be bring out every negative thing they're thinking about you. I know you think I've let you down. I know you think that I've not done the job that I'm being paid for. I expect you think that you can't trust me anymore. Get all of that stuff out of the table. Yeah. And what you're waiting for there is to hear that's right. In other words, yep, I have absolutely said everything horrible that that person is thinking about me. Right. And you've effectively cleared the air there. And then go in with a little, would it be horrible for me to share with you how I think we can move forward? Or would it be silly of me to share how I think we can move forward? What I'd like to suggest is we do this and then get their feedback on that, you know, ask them what they think or ask them what they think you need to do to move forward even better. And I think, you know, we're not very good at apologizing. We're not very good at saying we did something wrong. And, you know, doing
not without
that,
getting defensive.
Exactly. And doing that can go a long way to getting the right results.
Yeah. So to recap, it would be like to apologize, to acknowledge what you've done wrong or what the other person might be thinking, whether that's right or wrong. That doesn't matter. It's like what the other person is thinking.
Exactly.
And then the third thing would be setting certain expectations in terms of, okay, can we move forward from here on?
That's exactly right. So what you want to do is it seems like, it looks like, it feels like. Mm-hmm. You're not saying you agree with that, and that's the power of putting it that way, but you're acknowledging that that might be how they look or feel. And if you get it wrong, and sometimes you can put a wrong one out there just to get them to correct you. Never underestimate somebody's willingness to correct you. and you find out all sorts of information. But what you want is to put that out. You know, it's for them to acknowledge that, yes, you've summarized that well. And then once that's been cleared and they feel like they've been heard, you're going to have a much greater chance of sort of going, okay, well, how would we like to move forward?
Yeah.
You know, what do we need to do to move forward? And it's still going to take time. There's not an instant fix. You've got to follow that up with doing the right thing day in, day out.
Now, like to go through such a process, it can be quite intensive for a manager or leader. So what do you suggest that they look for to as support?
Great question. Look, in corporate, there's EAP programs, and we can chat about mental health because I think that's a big issue. But in terms of day-to-day support, I'm a great believer, and I've had a mentor since I was 18. And I would encourage any leader to surround themselves with great leaders and to watch and learn from them, but also potentially to identify a mentor that they can learn from. And often you'll find the mentor relationship, and I'm still talking to my mentor, and she now mentors me and I mentor her. So the relationship has evolved over the years, which is really good. But I think, you know, using people who you admire as a sounding board, you know, test out what you're thinking of doing, get them to say, is there anything else I'm missing, or is there anything else we could be doing here? We'll start to give you some support. As we touched on, being a leader can be an extremely lonely place. Mental health is a big issue. The statistics at the moment are 1 in 5 people within the Australian workplace. So this is a really important one for those who are managing a team, because if you've got 5 in your team, it's very possible that one of them is going to suffer from a mental health condition over the next year. Now, what I'm determining as mental health conditions in this frame, anorexia, that's actually quite big in legal firms, depression, anxiety, substance abuse, and even potentially suicide. Yeah. Now, of that, those statistics, we actually think that's moving closer to 1 in 4.
Wow.
The next time they do the results. So there's a whole lot of stuff going on here. There's a lot of people feeling very lonely. Anxiety is the biggest issue, and then closely followed by substance abuse and depression. But it varies from male to female where the levels are there. But the serious issue that we've got, Caroline, is that only 35% of people who are suffering from a mental health condition in the workplace will actually get treatment. Wow. So the impact of that is that they're much more likely to have a deeper episode or a follow-up episode because they haven't got any medical assistance through that. And it's one of those situations where people are feel very awkward about having that conversation, and we actually need to have that conversation. The Are You Okay? I highly recommend. Six of our team plus me did mental health first responder training, and we are finding we're getting a call a week from a client where they're trying to help someone. Sadly, one of our clients last week experienced a suicide of one of their team members. So this stuff does happen. We can't ignore it. The best thing we can do as a society is try and intervene earlier so that we can help people and get them back to work. And very many cases, they all come back to work, you know, but it is a big problem, and we need to be comfortable having that difficult conversation.
And I think like there is a big part that companies can play in making sure they have not only like the right programs in place, but also communicate about those programs. Yes. Half of the employees don't know they know they have a HR person, but they don't know what that entails and what's available for them as employee support if they're going through a tough time.
Yeah.
And they're too embarrassed to often also say something. I remember that the organization I worked for, they had like an anonymous like line that employees could call to, and the stats were terrifying how many people actually would take up that offer. So it was just like, because it wasn't only for the employees, it was also for their families.
Yes, so it's a fabulous thing. An EAP program and it is confidential. No one will know that you called. So I would encourage employees that have that, and often they get 4 to 6 sessions in that they can use without any cost to them or their family. And if we think about it, you know, you've got 1 in 3 first marriages ends in divorce, 1 in 2 second marriages. We've got 38% of Australians at the moment are feeling financially stressed, 38%. And we've got, you know, teenagers with, this is the scary thing, and this is another stat for you. 1 in 3 Australian girls at the moment are suffering from anxiety, and 35% of them will get treatment. And guess what? Those girls are going to be in the workforce in the next 2 to 10 years.
Yeah.
So that problem is just starting to snowball, and we need to do more about it. And so I would encourage anyone who's got an EAP program, don't be shy about it. Ring up. We get our team to use it because often we're involved in tough disputes and sometimes some nasty investigations, and our team will use it to debrief, you know, on that experience. And it's important that we offload that stuff, that we let it go. And that can be a very helpful way to do that.
Exactly. And I think also the stigma needs to get away from, needs to be taken away from a manager to be able to not talk to the team specifically to, I think you need it, but more like making them aware that that is okay, because we spend so much time at work, and often you see you can notice if a colleague is not doing well, and making sure that they know the right support and that they're comfortable in and knowing that their organization or their team or their boss is supporting them instead of shying away from it. Because I think like a lot of people just try to trying to not see it or ignore it because they just don't know what to do with it.
Yeah. And these problems won't go away. We do need to, as a society, you say, destigmatize mental health. It's just like any other health condition, but I would suggest people be much more comfortable having a conversation with someone who's got cancer than they would with somebody who's got depression or anxiety.
Yeah.
And it is starting to be, it is starting to change, but we've got a long way to go.
Yeah, exactly. My God, yes, definitely. So to wrap it all up and to make it concise, like, okay, What are the top three things that you would want to reflect on or to share or to highlight again that we have discussed? Because we have discussed so much during this episode. So what are the three keys that you would want to, the audience to take away?
Yeah. Number one, mental health in the workplace. It's around us all and we actually need to do something about it. And I would encourage anyone who's got some concerns about a team member or a colleague or a manager to reach out and get some support. That would be the number one. Number two is to understand your costs. So understand what it's costing you to not hire well, to not do a great orientation, to not understand how to interview or to not exit well. I think that's the second one. And the third one for me is around, I think just generally let's look to improve our skill set. Let's not rely on others to drive our training. Let's drive our own training and our own personal development and agitate for more training to be better. And invest in yourself. If your organization isn't prepared to do that, it's a really good investment because you take those skills with you. It doesn't matter if you leave that employer, you will always have that skill set and hold yourself to account. You know, I think that last piece around have your own KPIs and work out how you want to measure your own performance so you actually achieve what you want to achieve.
Exactly. Don't wait around till others make the decisions what your KPI should be, even if you don't see that your KPIs are really truly aligned with the outcome, because sometimes they're not really aligned.
Nope.
Make sure to set your own to actually measure your success in your job. Perfect. So thank you so much. Where can people connect with you and find out more and work with you basically?
Yeah. So two websites. One is employeematters.com.au and the other one's natashahawker.com. Mm-hmm. I've written a book called From Hire to Fire and Everything in Between, which is available at all good bookstores. It's on Amazon and Booktopia, or you can download a very cheap version from our website. And that's a great tool for business owners, but it's a fabulous tool for managers who want to understand how they need to manage their employees to get the most out of them, but also understand and the employee relations framework for which they're managing and for which they're liable. So that's probably the best way to get in touch with me.
Perfect. I will link it all up in the show notes also, so it's easy for people to click on it and to actually like explore and find out more and connect with you. Thank you so much. I learned so much talking to you. And like I said in the beginning, it was an honor having you on the show. And thanks for your time that you spent with us.
My pleasure. Let's help our clients and let's help our managers build employee assets and not liabilities.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.